When she was 17, Caroline Crampton was diagnosed with blood cancer. She went through the treatment. It receded, then returned, and then receded for good. She was declared cured at 22. No more annual checkups or scans or medications. They said she was cancer-free, but she was not free. The experience left her with an enduring fear that something was still or always wrong with her. She looked for signs and developed rituals, like this one she performed at work.
Who hasn't had a job that they find overwhelming or boring or difficult and snuck off to the bathroom every so often when they don't actually need to go, just in order to get a few minutes' peace or a break? And that, for me, transformed into this anxiety ritual. Every few days, at the worst times, every day, I would at some point think I could feel something in my neck where I'd had a cancerous tumour before. It would itch with this powerful urge to check it, and I would need to go off and check it before I could think about anything else.
The rhythms of this ritual are deeply ingrained. Lean forward, closer to the mirror, bracing hips against the sink. Old bruises accepting the hard angles. One hand to pull my shirt away from my left collarbone, the other to poke and prod the shadow I saw there. Always had to be the same bathroom, same mirror, and I had to poke it and poke it until I was satisfied that this time I was going to be okay. My gaze drops to the 2 square inches of skin on my neck to the left of my Adam's apple. This is the part of my body that most often flares into quivering sensation, and thus the part I know best. I could reconstruct it perfectly through touch alone, my fingertips following the baseline of the long-heeled scar that snakes along parallel with my collarbone, and the squashy dips between the tendons running down my neck. I know the pattern, but can still be stuck in it. It keeps revolving, a sing-song, meaningless wrangle. You know it's not real, but this time it might be real. The outcome is always the same. I always end up here, in front of this mirror, staring at this glassy, reflected version of me, quietly weeping and poking myself in the neck hard enough to leave marks. I did that I don't know how many times until I eventually started getting better. I think health anxiety or hypochondria can be very different for different people. For instance, I spoke to one person who it had manifested as a absolutely morbid fear of food poisoning, which had then translated into a fear of eating any food not that she hadn't prepared herself. And so she was terrified of restaurants, of eating at other people's houses, all because she was convinced that even the slightest tummy twinge meant that she had food poisoning. For her, no bathroom ritual, instead lots of anxieties and hang-ups around food. I know some people talked about it manifesting more as a kind of rage, that a really extreme anger and frustration that they feel in their whole body. This is one of the many reasons why it's quite a difficult thing for medical practitioners to isolate and diagnose, because it is so very different and there is no set, obvious way in which it presents in everybody. I think I wanted to make it clear that this can be something very mundane, something that takes place as often as you brush your teeth, and that I think the sort of stereotypes from culture about a ridiculous, hyper-anxious person pulling out their hair and being absurd, that it doesn't necessarily have to look like that, that it can be quite quiet and recognisable and invisible, and that people you know might be going through this right now and they're just keeping it from you. You are allowed to think it. I can hear you thinking it. I am a hypochondriac, or at least I worry that I am, which really amounts to the same thing. The fear that there is something wrong with me, that I am sick, is always with me. I doubt that what I experience are physical sensations, and I distrust my own interpretations of what I feel. Sometimes the anxiety is distant and muffled, like a radio playing in another room of the house, barely there. At other times, it is all I can hear.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Caroline Crampton is with us today. Her book is A Body Made of Glass.
I think you don't necessarily appreciate or realize how healthy you are until you're not. I think it's an experience more often had in the negative than the positive. So yes, for the first 16 years of my life, I had normal childhood illnesses, but nothing more serious than that. And so I never really thought about whether I would ever be healthy again or any big thoughts like that, because I had no reason to. And I was also very lucky that no one I knew, no friends or family members, went through protracted serious illnesses either. So I didn't even witness it up close like that, as some children do. And then when I was 17, I was diagnosed with something called Hodgkin's lymphoma, which is a cancer of the lymphatic system. And this really came out of the blue for me. It wasn't something I had suspected. I didn't realize in advance that it was lingering. I think a lot of people who go to an appointment with an oncologist will have some idea of what's going to happen. For whatever reason, I just didn't. I lived in a kind of teenage world of oblivion where I don't think I even really knew what an oncologist was. This was just an appointment that our family doctor had made for us, and so off we went. So that was a kind of before and after moment, shall we say, that diagnosed this cancer, laid out the treatment plan for me, and then it ended up being the next 5 years of my life were actively dominated by this illness. But then even once I was officially discharged, no more checkup appointments, they were happy to see me go. You aren't completely free of it. You never really are, because there's always the anxiety that it could come back. And I actually had an incident partway through where it was thought that it was all gone, and then actually it came back. So more treatment was necessary. So I'd sort of already had that happen once. So it felt like a very real possibility. And it doesn't help either that responsible, lovely doctors say things like, you know, you're the first line of defense. You must let us know if you have any cause for concern. You know, we always want to hear from you. We're waiting to help you at any time, which is great and evidence of very good care. But it also plants this seed in your brain that you must always be on alert. You must always be vigilant, because it could happen at any time. And so for the first few years, I think I probably deluded myself that the amount of checking and worrying I did about my state of health and my body were just responsible patienthood. You know, I was just doing what I was told. Right. I was just being vigilant. And that was because it, as described in that prologue, it was all initially focused on the cancer that I had had. So I was concerned about lumps appearing where there had been lumps before and other symptoms of that specific illness recurring. It was only when that pattern of thought, that anxiety, migrated from that specific set of symptoms to be more general and to be about things that were nothing to do with the cancer I had, could not be caused by that, that I started to twig that maybe there was something else underlying all of this, that I didn't just randomly have in my head all of these serious illnesses, that there was a sort of mental through line for all of them.
You don't think that, well, maybe you do, that the cancer triggered the hypochondria. I mean, is that something that happens? Is that a common thing, that an actual health event triggers a condition like this?
Yes, absolutely. I think that. Yeah. And it's something that's shown up in studies about health anxiety as well, that people who have had a serious prior condition of any kind are more prone to anxiety about their health because of exactly that effect, that they've been encouraged, their health anxiety has been legitimized in a way, because they were proven right about something, or that they've been given that watching brief to pay attention in case something serious develops. And
then that becomes a more generalized anxiety about all aspects of health. And so, yes, I very much do locate it in that, because the other triggers that are common for health anxiety include having a close family member who goes through a serious illness, or having another associated mental health condition like obsessive compulsive disorder. And I don't have any of those things. Mm. So all that's left really as a possible cause is the cancer.
Let's talk about the term hypochondria, what you do in the book, because it's you call it as a term slippery and elusive, but you've come to – you use it though, not health anxiety, which may be the more sort of up-to-date term, I suppose, but you kind of – I don't know. You kind of like it. It's nice, as you say, to reach for something to name these feelings that you have.
Yeah, so hypochondria is a slippery term. It's a very old word. It's been in use for hundreds of years in the current meaning of it, and thousands in a slightly different form. And over that time, it has accumulated a lot of baggage, shall we say. You know, it has been the source of stigma and dismissal. People have been dismissed as just hypochondriacs when they're trying to seek help for a medical condition. So for that reason, a lot of people don't like the word, both in the medical field and patients. They don't like it. They feel it's very intensely stigmatized and it carries all this baggage in a negative way. And that's definitely true. I don't dispute that. But I also think that just replacing a word, so, you know, doctors now prefer to say health anxiety rather than hypochondria. I don't think replacing the word necessarily replaces the history of dismissal and stigma that goes with it. And I also think that hypochondria can have, for some people, and I would count myself among them, it can have a kind of community effect, that it's a very isolating and lonely thing to be constantly worried about your own health. And if you identify yourself as a hypochondriac, you can attach yourself to other people who've done the same in books or films or in real life. And that gives you a sense of community. It's also, I think, a word that, just from experience, I found most people know it and understand it. Yeah. It's a pervasive word. Whereas I think if you say health anxiety, not so many people realize that that is a designated mental health condition rather than just two words casually put together. So for all of those reasons, I decided to use the word hypochondria in my book, even though it is officially designated archaic if you're a medical practitioner today.
Here's a kind of overly simplistic question that we'll dig into, but, you know, what is it? What is hypochondria? Because you mentioned in the book it resists definition. You say it's like oil sliding over water. And the definition is still shifting, but what is hypochondria?
Generally, it's a mental condition characterized by the persistent and unwarranted belief or fear that one has a serious illness. Yeah. That's the dictionary definition from the Oxford English Dictionary. And so that's the general realm we're in, fear or belief that one has a serious illness. And particularly the important word there is unwarranted. So it carries this connotation that although someone has the fear, they don't actually have the illness. So that's kind of my working definition. That's where I start. The reason I say it resists definition is because anytime you try and get any more specific than that, it just immediately collapses, I feel like. There have been lots of attempts to try and put proper diagnostic boundaries on it. So, for instance, in the DSM, the Diagnostics and Statistics Manual, which is generally called the Bible of Psychiatry, they talk about something called illness anxiety disorder. And as one of the lines, it says that these fears need to have been present and constant for at least 6 months in order for it to really be considered a disorder. How and why the figure 6 months was arrived at, they don't share. But also, I think it's perfectly possible that someone who's only been suffering it for 3 months could consider themselves a hypochondriac. And perhaps someone who's been feeling this way for a year might not wish to seek that diagnosis. So you see what I mean? As soon as you try and put specific parameters on it, I think it just stops encompassing everybody who it needs to include.
You know, this was helpful for me to understand it. But you mentioned in the book, hypochondria is a response to a threat. It's a way of coping. And you're right that it channels anxiety and fear into this sphere of health. And in that sense, it helps us to understand it, or helps, as you say, to make it feel productive. Say more about that.
I do think that in a way, hypochondria is part of the human condition and the human state of fearing mortality. It's the one certainty in life that one day we will all die. And I think that hypochondria is part of grappling with that, that fearing that you've got a life-threatening illness is a way of taking that really, really big concern that, you know, your life is finite and making it practical and day to day. So, well, I'm not going to think about the fact that I'm going to die, but I will think about the fact that maybe I've got this particular viral infection. You know, it makes it specific, and therefore it makes it a bit easier, I think, to get your head around. And there's definitely a strong association between health anxiety and stress, health anxiety and low mood, health anxiety and depression, lots of other mental health conditions that are characterized by sort of just difficulty in operating in life. And so I think that it's a way of expressing those feelings in a way that feels like there's going to be a solution, because I think we very much think of health as something that can be solved. You go to the doctor, you get a diagnosis, you get a medication, you are fixed. So I think it's a way of taking big unanswerable questions and trying to put them in a format where there could be answers.
You mentioned earlier, you referred to obsessive compulsive disorder, and it kind of raises a question for some people, I think, as OCD does. Hypochondria seems to raise this same kind of question. You know, do I have it? Does my own particular obsession with, in the case of OCD, you know, like my shoes need to face a certain way in the closet, or I need to have symmetry. If I touch something with the left hand, I have to touch something with the right hand, just sort of, you know, in ordinary life. You know, does that constitute OCD, or is it just kind of quirky, normal behavior? When does it cross over to actual OCD? And I wonder, do the same kinds of questions apply for hypochondria?
Yes, I think they do. I think the general feeling with a whole host of mental health conditions is that they cross over from just being a personality quirk or trait into being a diagnosable entity when it becomes life-limiting. You know, when someone feels like it's impinging their ability to do what they want to do and live their life in the way that they want to live. Because a lot of these psychological conditions, a lot of psychology full stop, is about self-reporting and self-referring. These are not things that you can see on an x-ray. It has to be the patient themselves volunteering the information. And so there is always going to be total subjectivity to it. And therefore, you know, the threshold for someone at which something becomes life-limiting might be different from someone else. But the important thing is that they feel that way. And so I think there is, with health anxiety and hypochondria, there is a sense in which that some people may just have a higher tolerance for these anxieties than others. You know, some people may, you know, go to pieces at the first sign of, you know, a rash or a cough. Other people may be able to kind of hold those thoughts at bay for much longer. But I think the best thing to do with all of this is to approach it with compassion and empathy. That's really the big thing that I took away from doing the book. I think people have devoted decades and decades of science to trying to isolate precise definitions and lines and thresholds, when actually perhaps a lot of time could have been saved by just saying, well, if you say you feel that way, I believe you.
Do we know how many people have it? Not just the sheer numbers, but like as a percentage. And I think you often hear in some cases that it's becoming more prevalent. I don't know if that's actually true, because it does make you wonder if the conditions of modern life, which do seem to stoke a lot of anxiety, is making hypochondria more prevalent. But I don't know, how many people do actually have it, and is it growing as a condition?
It's really hard to say. I've found really different figures all over the place. I've seen 5%, 10%, 20% in different studies. It seems like, depending on how you ask the question, you get a different rate. But what I think you can say with certainty, that it is a non-negligible proportion of the population. You know, we're not talking about a sort of statistical margin of error. It is a substantial chunk of people. And then regarding the question of whether it's increasing, whether the numbers are growing, it's definitely something that lots of people I've spoken to sort of feel in their gut is true. It feels like something that would be true. You know, we've had a global pandemic within the last 5 years. We have always on, ever-present internet devices that are feeding us misinformation about health. There seem to be lots and lots of factors involved. Again, difficult to find hard data that shows that, so we're operating in the realm of anecdote, but it certainly feels like an idea that checks out. If there was a blood test for it, we would have much better information.
Caroline Crampton, her book is A Body Made of Glass, A Cultural History of Hypochondria. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Caroline Crampton's Cultural History of Hypochondria, where she explores the relationship between, as she puts it, illness real and imagined. Part of the book is memoir, part of it is the history of the condition, and part of it is digging into the memoirs and letters of others, those who have shared this health anxiety over the years, like Darwin and Proust. The book is A Body Made of Glass. Let's talk about the history, because you write about that. When did people first become aware of this condition? You say Hippocrates used the word hypochondria in the 5th century BCE. So this is, at least as a notion, as a term, it's pretty ancient.
It is. So part of what drew me to this word and this subject matter is its incredibly long history. But when Hippocrates is using the word hypochondria in the 5th century BCE, he's not using it in the sense that we're using it today. He's using it as an anatomical term for a part of the torso where the liver resides. He does, however, describe more than one patient with a undefinable anxiety about their health that he, as the physician, cannot diagnose. And he uses phrases like, someone being of a melancholic turn of mind that is showing itself through physical symptoms. So he is identifying things that we now would recognize as hypochondria, but he's not using that word to describe it. The way that the word hypochondria becomes associated with that mental state of mental distress with physical symptoms is because of this theory of the four humors, which was the dominant way of understanding health and the body in Europe and the West for over 1,000 years. And it's this idea in which the body is comprised of these four essential substances or humours: black bile, yellow bile, blood and phlegm. And in order to be healthy, all four of those substances need to be in balance, in harmony. And a deficiency or an excess of any one will cause particular symptoms or particular conditions. So there's a whole very complicated chart. It's almost like an astrological chart of these four humours and all of the things they're associated with. An excess of black bile is produced in the liver, which is in the hypochondrium region of the body, is associated with melancholy, depression, anxiety. So the two things just become linked in that way, the word hypochondria and this feeling of melancholy. And then as the theory of the four humours is superseded by better science in the medieval period and into the sort of 16th and 17th centuries,
the association sticks, even though people no longer have beliefs about black bile. Mm-hmm. They still think of this mental distress and the word hypochondria. So that's how the new definition arises, how it crosses over from being a condition of the body to being one of the mind.
You mentioned how, well, it's difficult to talk about, you know, your experiences to people you know. What you have what you describe as this long-running conversation with the hypochondriacs of centuries past, and we'll get to some of these stories as we go. But you say it's not necessarily easy to spot this condition in documents, official documents and obituaries in the past, because it's just rarely used. So what do you see, and where do you actually find these references?
So, yes, it's a very rare designation. In fact, I think one of the only examples of a hypochondriac I've found is in the New York Times obituary for Tennessee Williams, where in the opening lines they write, you know, he was a playwright and a noted hypochondriac. They really led with that. But that's very unusual most of the time, because it isn't and has never really been a sort of official medical diagnosis or an official disease or an official status. You just don't see it coming up a lot in those kind of accounts of lives. So when you're looking for it, you have to look a little bit closer. You have to look in people's diaries, in their journals, in their letters, and see how they describe their own feelings and then match that up with what we know to be hypochondria. So an interesting example would be someone like Elizabeth Barrett Browning, the poet, who for about the first 40 years of her life was an excessive invalid. You know, she was constantly having different aches and pains that doctors couldn't diagnose. At various times, she was completely incapacitated. You know, she was physically unable. She couldn't walk properly. And yet she was very wealthy, so she saw doctors constantly, and yet none of them was ever able to really do anything for her or give her a diagnosis. And then she meets Robert Browning and she runs away with him and gets married. And then for the rest of her life, she suddenly seems to be very energetic and she doesn't have any of these problems anymore. She travels all over Europe. She has children. You know, she writes a lot of poetry. She basically just lives a very active and seemingly fulfilled life. And so something like that, you might look at that and go, so was she actually physically unwell, or was she experiencing mental distress and anxiety because of she lived with a very, very draconian and overbearing father who limited every aspect of her life? Could it be that perhaps there was something else going on? So that's the kind of process I'm talking about in terms of looking for hypochondriacs in history.
Let's talk about Marcel Proust. It's a really interesting case study in the book. He was somewhat like you in your experience, in the sense that he had this pre-existing condition, I guess you could put it that way, that seemed to trigger his hypochondria. Tell us about Proust. It's a really interesting case.
Yeah, so he was ill from childhood with asthma and allergies and sort of respiratory problems. And he underwent a lot of treatment and procedures for this, including one that sounds really horrible called nasal cauterizing, where they basically shoved something really hot up his nose in an attempt to prevent him being constantly triggered by sort of dust and pollen. It did not work. Yeah. And as he grew up, he continued to have what I think we would today consider to be genuine physical ailments in his respiratory system, but he also had incredible anxiety about them. And his anxiety seemed to produce more symptoms. And it also caused him to make decisions about his life that ultimately made him more sick, in the sense that he was completely paranoid that cooking smells, the, you know, fragrance of frying food or whatever, would bring on an attack. So there was a period where he basically didn't really eat because he was so worried about this. The same goes for heating his apartment in Paris. I mean, it's kind of partly true that smoky fires are not the best for people with asthma and sensitive breathing problems. But his response was, well, I just won't have fires then in case they make me unwell. And of course, the cold then made him unwell. So he was sort of trapped in this thing of, well, I, I do feel ill sometimes, but also I'm very worried about being ill. Everything I do for my illness seems to make me worse. And you can see how that would produce, just as we were saying, life-limiting anxiety.
I think what's interesting about Proust's story too is that what influence, like, his father had on the way he, his condition. You mentioned his father, who was this, you know, prominent epidemiologist who just kind of thought it was in his son's head, that it was just, he was overly sensitive. And this is something you write in the book. You say over time, Proust became, he became that delicate and sensitive person that his father feared he already was. So it was almost like it became this kind of self-fulfilling prophecy for Proust. Is that part of understanding this condition of hypochondria?
I think it is. I think when you have a very strong authority figure in your life in the way that Proust's father was for him, and especially one, you know, in the medical field as well, if they characterize you in a certain way, if they give you a role, I think it's very difficult to resist that in a less dramatic way and not to do with illness. I think you see that in a lot of families, you know, say if you've got multiple children, the set story might become that, oh, the oldest one is so responsible and hardworking, and the youngest one is so carefree and irresponsible. Whether or not that's actually the features of the people involved, that will become the family lore, right, the family myth. And over time, people might find themselves actually inhabiting those roles that have been provided for them purely because it's easier than resisting and saying, no, actually, I'm not like that. I'm like this. So I think that's what happened to Proust. It's just a more advanced level of something that we see quite often in families, is that the shorthand actually becomes the truth. And I think it had a really devastating impact on his life, that he writes about this in his letters, about how not just his father, but his father's influence on other people, on his siblings and his friends, all that, you know, oh, Marcel, he's such a weak little warrior, became the way that they all expected him to behave anyway.
The title of the book, A Body Made of Glass, you know, it sounds like a just a kind of a poetic way to describe this condition, but there's something quite literal in the idea here. I wanted to ask you about it. So there's this, the Greek physician, Galen, he notices this strange condition. Patients who believe, I guess they literally believe they are made of pottery. We'll get to glass in a moment, but maybe start there. Tell us this part of the story.
Yeah, so from sort of the 2nd century AD, physicians were noticing something that came to be called the earthenware delusion, where people in great mental distress would believe that they were made of pottery and that any kind of force or violence could cause them to smash and cease to exist. And it's something that crops up through the centuries in the notes of different physicians and medical writers in different parts of the world. And it's often included in lists of other delusions, like people who think that the sky is going to fall on them, or that they think they're a chicken is another example that gets given. So it's bracketed in that area. And then in sort of the 14th, 15th century, when glass starts to become not a, a prized rarity only for the very rich, but a material used widely in buildings and that lots and lots of people are familiar with, the earthenware delusion disappears and is replaced by what's called the glass delusion, which is the same thing, people believing that they are made of glass, either wholly or partially. Some people thought they just had one glass limb or one glass body part or glass head or even a glass organ. Glass heart was quite common. But the same fear that they will smash if they come into contact with anything or if anyone, you know, jostles them violently. It provokes a lot of derision and merriment, really. Yeah. There's a lot of sort of comic plays written about it. There's some famous stories of I think a baker in Paris who thought that his buttocks were made of glass, and his doctor thrashes him to prove to him that, well, you didn't break because I hit you so hard and yet you're still in one piece. So it's something that arouses ridicule in people. And
gradually the glass delusion changes too. So, I mean, there was a recorded case of it in the Netherlands in the 1960s where the patient didn't fear any longer that he was breakable, because glass has become a much stronger material since then. We now build skyscrapers out of it and bridges that we can walk on. Instead, he feared that he was transparent, that he was made of glass in the sense that people could see through him, that he would become invisible.
Wow.
And as I was reading about this, I found it fascinating. And it seemed to me a really good metaphor for how it feels to have hypochondria. The glass delusion is not hypochondria. It is a recorded delusion among many others. But that feeling of being breakable and transparent and brittle, but only you can know that you are, that to everyone else you just look completely fine and normal. That seemed to me exactly what it feels like to have hypochondria. And so that's why I gave that title to the book.
The glass delusion appears in a Cervantes novella. And I was really interested in this because the twist in the Cervantes story is interesting, because the character in the story, Tomás, who has this glass delusion, doesn't necessarily become this subject of ridicule. He comes to be sought after for his wise counsel because people believe his condition made him more sensitive to the world. And that's a spin that seems, I don't know, unique, or really maybe it says something of the time, but I thought that was unique or original.
Definitely. I haven't come across that in any other places. Mm. Most of the other media about this is sort of bawdy plays, yeah, about, you know, people being urinated on because they're urinals and they're made of glass, that kind of thing. Mm. Whereas the Cervantes story is much more philosophical than that. Initially, the character's friends, I think, do try and use rough humour to snap him out of it. You know, they try and embrace him really tightly to prove to him that he doesn't break. But all that happens is he passes out from anxiety and doesn't remember anything about it. And he comes up with a way to live with it. You know, when he has to travel to another city, he has himself packed in straw as if he's a vase being transported, and he gets moved along that way. And he always sleeps out of doors so that there can be no question of, you know, a building falling on him or anything like that. So he finds a way to live with it. And I think over the years in the story, people come to have a grudging respect for that, you know, well, this man clearly has this delusion that we don't perceive, but he is nonetheless thriving, I suppose, is the idea. And I think, therefore, they come to appreciate a mind that can hold those contradictions and yet still function. And that's why he becomes sought after as a kind of wise man.
There's this thing you write in the book about understanding hypochondria as having the structure of a narrative, and, you know, a beginning, a middle, and an end. And I wanted to ask you about that, because you say that an illness is a story we tell about ourselves, and that the story is the kind of the connective tissue that joins together, as you say in the book, the symptoms with the perceptions of the symptoms, and that helps us make sense of them. Would you say a little bit more about this?
I think how would you call it? A successful illness, or an illness that follows the expected pattern, very much has all of the classic beats of a good story, in the way that, you know, a really successful film feels narratively satisfying. You know, it sets up all of these different questions, and then by the end, they've all been answered. I think that's what we expect from an illness, that it poses a question which is answered with a diagnosis, which is then followed up with a treatment, and the treatment is successful, and then the person lives happily ever after at the end. And we've developed lots of cultural habits around this idea. Even in the language that we use when we say that someone lost their battle with cancer, we are
participating in that narrative structure. We're saying that, you know, there was a sad tragedy in the third act of the story and they didn't make it to the end, is what we're really saying. And then when illnesses don't conform to the expected structure, they can make us very uncomfortable. I experienced some of this when I was unwell. I was under 18, which meant that I was, during the initial part of my cancer treatment, officially classified as a child, even though I'd been about to go to college and in every other way, you know, I could drive. I was considered almost an adult, if not already there. And so I had things happen like, you know, charities offering, like sort of Make-A-Wish type charities offering to give me the experience of a lifetime because I was a child with cancer. And I was having to say to them, like, I really think that's an opportunity that should go to someone else because that's not the cancer story I want for myself. You know, I don't want to get to go in a hot air balloon for the one last time because I might be about to die. I don't want that. And so I felt like, because I didn't want to participate in that story, I felt like I had to keep everything secret, that if I wasn't going to do it in this very public and official way where I, you know, recovered and then started doing fundraising marathons for a relevant charity, that therefore I just couldn't talk about it at all. And that was all down to the dominance of this narrativized idea of illness.
Caroline Crampton, her book is A Body Made of Glass, A Cultural History of Hypochondria. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back to our conversation with Caroline Crampton. She's written A Cultural History of Hypochondria. It's a form of anxiety that resists definition. Crampton says in the book she herself is a hypochondriac, or at least she worries she is, which she says basically amounts to the same thing. The book is called A Body Made of Glass. I want to ask about Charles Darwin and his hypochondria, because you write about this school trip that you went on to Darwin's residence townhouse. And in his study, there's this bathtub, and as they say there, this is a place where Darwin could sort of sort himself out. Say more about Darwin.
Charles Darwin, I think, was a very strange man. I think because he was also a great scientist and a proponent of, you know, one of the foundational ideas of modern science, this gets a bit overlooked. But he was also very peculiar in his habits. And he, during his lifetime, experienced a lot of very disparate symptoms and illnesses that couldn't be satisfactorily explained by his doctors. And therefore, he turned to, as many people do, alternative remedies and ideas to try and find some relief and to connect them together into a story that he could live with and understand. And one of the main things he adopted was something called a water cure, which was a health, and I guess today we would say wellness, regime that involved a lot of drinking cold water and also bathing in it at a regimented timetable. And so because he was also very busy and working all the time, he had a bathtub installed in his office so that he could jump straight in, do his water cure, and then jump straight out and carry on working. And he ran his whole household on these principles. So his children later in life wrote about how it was sort of more than their lives were worth to disrupt the pattern of his days. He also set a great store on exercise as a way of relieving his symptoms, which is still something that's very recommended today. So he had this area of his estate where his house is, where he'd timed the walk precisely, and he would do sort of circuits of it at different times of the day because he knew exactly how long it was going to take. So when you look at someone like Darwin, you can say, is that someone who, did he have some underlying physical disease that connected all of those things? Or was he perhaps someone who experienced great anxiety and found a way to manage it through lifestyle factors, which is something that could very easily be said to you today if you had that set of conditions. So I think his story is an interesting one because it in some ways feels very modern.
Mm. So if cold water, we don't know if that exactly works. As you said, exercise could be helpful. But what other kinds of actual relief do you think you could offer for people such as yourself who have this condition? Like, how is it that you live with it? Because you write about EMDR, for example. You write about cognitive behavioral therapies. Not solutions necessarily here, but ways to live with it and treat it. How are you thinking about all of that?
The best way I have come to think about it is that it's just a trait I have, in the same way that I have brown hair or long legs, that I just have this predisposition to this particular kind of anxiety. And I can't, therefore, likely eradicate it completely, but I can accommodate it. I can live with it. And that's where various different kinds of therapy come in, that you can essentially train your mind to recognize when you are being governed by the anxiety and when you are not. And when you are, you can learn how to sort of step outside of those thoughts and say, well, am I really dying, or do I actually just need to, you know, take a step back, calm down, and then think about this again in a few hours' time? And so cognitive behavioral therapy is really helpful for developing those techniques, and it is just something you have to practice and practice and practice. EMDR therapy is helpful for processing any past trauma that is heightening those anxiety episodes. It's a therapy that is used for people with post-traumatic stress disorder, and it was helpful to me in sort of neutralizing some of the memories I had about medical procedures that were really amplifying my anxiety, because it's like, well, I don't want to go back there. I don't want to go back to the hospital where that happened to me. So it's helpful for that reason. But I think, yeah, overall, just that understanding that this isn't a temporary state. I think when you have health anxiety, you can be inclined to put off living in a way. You can think, well, I can't apply for that job, or I can't move there, or I can't do this until I get this sorted out with my health. I can't do this. And of course, you just end up postponing everything that might bring you joy. So I think coming to a realization that, no, I'll probably always be like this in some regard, and therefore I should just do things and figure it out as I go. I think that's the overarching helpful understanding.
Finally, there's a John Donne line that you say helped you sort of let go of the idea that you need to try and be less fragile or be, you know, or sensitive. Something that Donne wrote about the variable and miserable condition of man. Will you say something about that, finally?
So John Donne says, "Variable and therefore miserable condition of man, this minute I was well and I am ill this minute." And I found this very profound. He wrote this when he was very ill, in a text called The Devotions, where he documented his thoughts while he was in the grip of a very serious fever and illness. And what he's saying there, I think, is that the human condition is challenging and miserable because it's so changeable, that we're not ever one thing completely forever, that we shift and change and alter all the time, and we're constantly having to grapple with that. And "I was well and I am ill this minute," I think, is how I and a lot of people with hypochondria feel, that I can wake up feeling dreadful and by lunchtime I might feel fine, and then I might feel a bit off again by dinner. And once I think I thought I had to stop that, I had to find a way to never feel like that and just feel the same all the time, because isn't that how healthy people feel? And instead, guided by John Donne, I've just come to accept that as part of the human condition as I experience it, that things change, I change, but you just keep putting one foot in front of the other.
Caroline Crampton, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Caroline Crampton, her book is A Body Made of Glass, A Cultural History of Hypochondria. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Instagram at Radio West, on YouTube at KUER 90.1. Our email address is radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Aidan Oneida. The program is produced by Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.